Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. Additional support for The Pulse is provided by AstraZeneca and Independence Blue Cross.
If it barks, it's a dog, but probably not a service dog, even if it says so on his vest. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
The galaxy we live in is on a crash course with Andromeda.
Beep, beep. Yes, you dream about it.
Giraffes don't faint.
No, they don't.
You just go about your life, and you don't notice a thing because it's just you.
Don't be so occupied with what you expect out of it, because that's bad science.
That's sometimes not so easy for somebody to let go.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
What happened?
Tomato started to hit me in the face.
Interrupt this task.
No, I've got you're just going to have a new cane or cane.
You know, MS is always going to be in your living room. It just shouldn't be in the center of your living room.
On today's show, we learn that the path to a cleaner harbor sometimes goes through dark alleys. We explore if greener cars are just a pipe dream and when a doctor's visit could mean taking a huge risk. But first up, let's say you have a dog and you're about to go on a trip that involves air travel, but you don't want your dog to fly cargo in a crate. Well, do you have $25? If you were so inclined, you could buy a service dog vest online, along with a really official-looking card that states, "I am a service animal and my right to accompany my handler is protected by federal law." A friend recently told me about these vests, and it got me wondering if fake service dogs are really a thing. So I called a couple of veterinarians to see if they had come across this. I got a hold of Colin Dwyer. He's a vet in New York City. And he said, yeah, he gets asked to certify pets as service dogs all the time.
I usually tell them that I'm not going to lie and put my license on the line just so their dog can sit next to them on a plane. You know, I'd like my dog to sit next to me on a plane, too. But
so you think that's what it's about, people? For convenience?
That's 100% what it's about, and most people are very upfront about it. They're like, I don't want my dog to go in the cargo hold, so do you think I could get him certified as a service animal?
But as I looked into it some more, it turned out you don't even need a note from a vet. Even if you threw a vest on your 15-year-old howling beagle who can barely walk or see, chances are you would get away with it. How is this possible? Service dogs are doing a lot of new things these days, which has been a boon for people with different disabilities and health issues. But as is often true with new developments, it has also created confusion, loose rules, and opportunities for fraud. I thought a good place to figure out what is happening would be the Penn Vet Working Dog Center in Philadelphia. They are training dogs to do all kinds of work, and they're doing a lot of research.
Check.
This is where I met Punches, an adorable yellow lab. She is just a bit over a year old, and while her peers may be out in the world sniffing, you know, all the things that dogs sniff, she's walking around in a circle trying to detect low blood sugar.
Focus.
Punches is one of several dogs at the center. Her trainer, Jonathan Ball, is spinning a contraption made from wooden beams that holds four jars containing saliva samples.
Yes, good girl. So she gives a down indication when she finds the correct sample.
The sample Punches is supposed to detect was donated by a person with diabetes while their blood sugar was low. The three other jars contain normal saliva samples.
Yeah, that's it. Good girl. So at any point she indicates that there's the odor, I'm going to reward her.
Punches keeps getting it right. She's already paired up with her future owner, a young woman who comes in a few times a week to get used to having a service dog, which will cost her $20,000. Before Punches leaves the center, she has to learn a lot more than smelling blood sugar dropping. Anne-Marie D'Angelo is in charge of training the dogs at the center.
There is access skills like riding up and down an escalator, elevator, getting in and out of a car. Social skills, they can't react to people walking up behind them. They have to remain calm and confident and with their handler and focused on that handler.
Punches is part of Generation 2.0 of service dogs, if you will, exploring new frontiers of what dogs can do. Here's Cindy Otto. She is a veterinarian who heads the Penn Vet Working Dog Center.
Typically, we think of guide dogs. Those are sort of the classic ones. There's hearing assistance dogs. There are mobility assistance dogs, dogs that support autism, post-traumatic stress disorder. Those are all service dogs.
What does a PTSD dog do?
One of the classic things they do is what they call a block, and that just keeps the distance between the person and anybody who might be approaching. So that keeps that person's space a little bit bigger.
What makes all of these dogs service dogs under the Americans with Disabilities Act is that they are providing specific services to the person they are working with. And by the way, the ADA only recognizes dogs as service animals. Miniature horses, for example, and yes, that is a thing, are excluded. But the ADA is also very specific about what is not a service dog. First, pets. Sure, they perform the service of loving us, but that doesn't qualify. And
there's another area that's a little bit more of a gray zone, but truly are not service dogs. And those are the therapy dogs. And they do a wonderful job making people feel better, helping people. But those are not service dogs.
If your dog qualifies as a service dog, they can go anywhere you go. The Federal Justice Department just clarified and updated all of the rules related to service dogs. And legally, staff in restaurants, bus drivers, airport workers, they may only ask two specific questions. One, is the dog a service animal required because of a disability? And two, what work or task has the dog been trained to perform? They are not allowed to request paperwork for the dog or ask any specific questions about the person's disability because that might violate their privacy.
Was that delicious?
Meet Wynn. He's a yellow lab who just got a treat for picking up Allison Brady's cell phone, which fell on the floor.
I've had 3 strokes, so I use him for stability, and he's a seizure alert dog.
She's had Wynn since the summer of 2013. This is her 3rd service dog. The previous 2 are retired, but still living with her.
In 2004, I was having about 100 seizures in a month. I didn't know what to do. I was in a quandary. I'd be walking down the street of Philadelphia and end up on the ground and people just walk around me.
Allison Brady was born with an arteriovenous malformation in her brain. It's an abnormal connection between veins and arteries that causes her seizures. Wynn and the service dogs that came before him either sense or smell when she's about to have a seizure.
First he'll put his paws on my lap and then he'll put his paws on my chest.
And what does that do for you?
It just says, hey, you're going to stay right here.
This prevents falls and injuries. Allison will sit down right where she is, and sometimes Wynn alerts people to help her. The fact that Allison's disability is not immediately visible has meant that sometimes people have told her she can't bring Wynn into a store or restaurant. And on occasion, she's run into some dogs wearing service vests that she wasn't so sure about because they didn't act like they were working.
A little bit yappy or doesn't have total control.
Allison says she doesn't let this bother her, but Cindy Otto from the Penn Vet Working Dog Center does not take kindly to fakes.
Because people who love their dogs and want to travel with their dogs or take their dogs places, yes, they mean well, but they're really causing a problem because their dogs aren't trained for this. And any problems that they cause really are going to create problems for the people who rely on those dogs for their life.
It means people are getting eye rolls and lots of questions. By the way, Wynn sat by Allison's feet the entire time during our conversation without even making the tiniest sound, which is great if you're on a plane, not so great for radio.
He's calm and he listens.
Allison got Wynn from an organization called Canine Partners for Life. She knows how they train their dogs, so she felt comfortable that he'd be able to perform the tasks she needs him to do, because that can be a tricky thing, too. There are no federal standards or procedures for certifying a service animal, and people looking to buy a dog like that have to do a lot of research and homework. Cindy Otto wishes tighter rules were in place.
I definitely believe there needs to be some sort of oversight or certification. The dog has to achieve certain criteria. When we look at our police dogs, when we look at our search and rescue dogs, they all have to pass a test. And that needs to be there so that we have confidence that they can do the job that they're doing.
Otto says this would not only protect consumers from buying a dog that can't do its job, but it would likely stop pet owners from trying to bring this guy on the plane with them. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Da, da, da. Da, da, da. This was the theme of VW commercials back in the 90s. Fun, right? But this past week has not been fun at all for Germany's best-known brand and the world's biggest automaker. On September 18th, news broke that the Environmental Protection Agency ordered VW to recall 482,000 diesel cars in the U.S., claiming that the company had installed software designed to defeat smog regulations tests. On Monday, the head of VW USA admitted the company had done wrong.
So let's be clear about this. Our company was dishonest with the EPA and the California Air Resources Board and with all of you. And in my German words, we have totally screwed up.
Of course, VW's stock tanked.
Sorry, didn't cut it with investors. VW stock drove off a cliff, down more than 17% in the U.S. The company saw more than $14 billion go up in smoke in one trading session.
Then on Tuesday, it started to look like this problem was far bigger than a U.S. issue.
Volkswagen admitting in a statement the deception involves some 11 million vehicles worldwide.
On Wednesday, VW CEO Martin Winterkorn resigned, and while the company plots a way out of this mess they've created, the cult following of VW is mad and lawyering up.
Two Volkswagen car owners filed separate federal class action lawsuits in Chicago and Newark on Tuesday, alleging the company misled them into buying a green car that was actually rigged to evade emission standards. The lawsuits were filed.
Some are calling this VW Gate. Others are using the term Diesel Gate. Rob Harley, the head of UC Berkeley's Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering and an expert on diesel fuel, says that's not fair. We've asked him to talk to us a little bit more about the fate of diesel going forward. Rob, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
What does all of this mean for the future of diesel? Do you think people will have any faith in it going forward?
Diesel's going to remain with us. I don't think this is really endangering the future of diesel fuel in the transportation sector. There's such a huge use of it in the heavy-duty truck sector. Diesel's going to remain.
But can diesel still be a clean fuel?
With the right emission controls, absolutely it can be a clean fuel. The recent stories have been about emission controls that didn't work. And with the right emission controls, any fuel can be clean.
What do the right emission controls entail? Can you give us an example?
So there's a number of different pollutants that we're trying to control from cars, whether they run on gasoline or diesel fuel. And diesel has two kind of particular concerns. One is the black smoke that's kind of characteristic of a lot of diesel engines. And so we need a filter for that and a way of regenerating the filter so it doesn't plug up over time. That's a well-developed technology now, and it's pretty widespread. There's another pollutant called nitrogen oxides, and it's not really coming from the fuel itself directly. It's coming from the nitrogen and oxygen present in the air used for combustion. And that requires some kind of catalytic converter in order to control those emissions of the nitrogen oxides or NOx. That's a harder problem, and it's one where there's maybe a fuel economy penalty, so there's motivation to not be as aggressive there or any more aggressive there than you have to be.
What are some options that perhaps are being worked on right now, but consumers don't even know about them yet?
You know, I think the big development efforts for the future are on the battery, on the electric vehicle side, maybe developing new approaches to having hybrid systems, alternate ways of maybe swapping batteries rather than recharging at home. And there's another possibility is to try and run vehicles on fuel cells that would use hydrogen. So that's maybe a competing approach to the battery power.
How competitive is this field of developing these new models? Who are the big players?
Well, locally here in the Bay Area, there's a company called Tesla, which is very aggressively working on electric vehicle development. They're also engaged in related companies working in the solar power industry. But you know, many vehicle manufacturers are really thinking about the future. In California, we've committed to pushing down the CO2 or the carbon dioxide emissions from burning fossil fuels. And we've committed to transitioning to non-fossil energy sources for the transportation sector. That's going to happen over a timescale of decades, but the decision's already been made.
You're an expert on diesel. You've been obviously following this in the news. What did you think when you first heard about all of this?
We've seen similar kinds of issues of what we call cycle beating or defeat devices used to circumvent the NOx emission requirements in the past. Back in the 1990s, we saw kind of not exactly the same in detail, but similar kinds of issues going on with heavy-duty diesel trucks. So I was really surprised that we would see this again. I thought, you know, everyone knew that it would not be acceptable to kind of do this kind of thing, especially since it's happened before and that the consequences have been pretty severe for the engine manufacturers back in the 1990s when the same kind of issue came up.
In the wake of all that has happened, why do you still believe that diesel is a good fuel?
Diesel has some real advantages over gasoline in terms of fuel economy. The freight sector, the big trucks have used diesel fuel almost exclusively for a long time for, you know, in large part that reason. But let me just say a little bit about diesel fuel. First of all, you know, we buy our fuel by the gallon, and diesel's denser, so you get more fuel energy per gallon when you buy diesel fuel. But there's also advantages of the engine itself. The diesel engines typically run at higher temperature and higher pressure compared to gasoline, and that gives them an efficiency advantage. And there's also some other mechanical advantages in the design of diesel engines. And then finally, they run with excess air, so you get a little bit more complete combustion of the diesel fuel. So all of these things, you know, if we're in this era looking forward where there's pressure to improve fuel economy, diesel fuel and diesel engines have some really useful things to offer. And we just have to be sure that in achieving those fuel economy benefits, we don't sacrifice on black smoke or nitrogen oxide emissions, which are things you have to also be attentive to.
So you think this too shall pass?
Yes, diesel's going to remain viable. It's a big blip, though, what we're seeing. This is, the stories are that it may be beyond just the United States, that it may extend to a significantly larger number of vehicles in Europe as well. And this is a setback for use of diesel in the automotive sector.
Rob, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Rob Harley is the engineering department chair at UC Berkeley. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. It just may be easier to move an asteroid than to find out how much a medical procedure is going to cost you before getting it done. This is an issue we've been exploring on The Pulse, and as part of a growing quest for cost information, a lot of insurance companies are now offering estimator tools. The idea is that people can look up and compare the approximate cost of certain procedures beforehand. Sounds great, right? The Pulse's Alana Gordon takes a closer look.
This story begins with a couple who was recently thrown into the thick of healthcare costs. They live about an hour north of Philadelphia.
I'm Scott Savette.
Kate Savette.
We met in 2005 on eHarmony.
They got married in 2007, moved to Allentown, PA.
And love and life up here.
Scott and I are very lucky because we both get to work from home.
Scott's a chemist. He designs scientific software for labs. He works upstairs. Kate works in life insurance.
Which is just as exciting as it sounds.
Her office is downstairs. That's where you can also find Frankie. Their wonder pug.
Come here, Frank. Hi.
Scott is 43, Kate 37. They hadn't used their insurance much until this year.
For me, it's been relatively minor stuff, but, you know, certainly the costs do add up. For Kate, it's been a little more, what?
I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis this year.
It happened in January. Kate recalls she couldn't feel parts of her body. Doctors thankfully figured out what was going on pretty quickly.
Because I had so many symptoms that were involved with my first attack.
But still, they had to do a lot of tests and follow-up tests. And separately, Scott needed an MRI for a spinal issue. Under their insurance plan, they're on the hook for a combined $8,000 of their care. So they wanted to find the best place for the best deal. But how?
So to get to it, you first have to log in to the main UnitedHealthcare site.
They investigated with the help of a nifty online tool offered through their insurance.
And from there, on the right-hand side here, an icon that says estimate healthcare costs.
Scott opens his computer and logs into the cost estimator tool. He types in a procedure, an MRI scan,
without dye,
and voila.
Okay, so it tells us that in our area, the average cost is $1,270. The lowest would be $512.
The tool also gives him a list of providers in his area and shows a specific estimated cost of the procedure at each of the places under his plan. This seemed great, but for Scott and Kate, the tool quickly became a headache.
2 days before Kate was scheduled to have her first MRI, we got a call from the provider saying, oh, by the way, the MRI is $2,400. I looked at the cost estimator. Cost estimator told me it would be $500 and change. So what's the disconnect?
They learned that a hospital had bought the facility, and so the prices had all gone up. That wasn't reflected in the estimator. They looked for other options.
We called at least four or five places.
Did you get answers right away?
Not necessarily. And in fact, the MRI that I'm having in less than an hour, I have no idea how much it's going to cost.
The tool misquoted them for other procedures too, often by more than $1,000.
I was frustrated, mad. I mean, I went through the range of emotions.
Financial planning went out the window. They pushed back buying a new water heater for their house.
It's just really hard for us to pull the trigger on something like that, knowing that another bill could be coming around the corner.
It's unclear how common these inaccuracies with estimator tools are. Experts I interviewed couldn't point me to a comprehensive study that focused on this. But the tools are becoming more common. Private companies, small and large, are touting various products.
So you can research costs, shop smart, and find the best value for your health services.
Healthcare consumer. And as healthcare consumers, you have a right to know your medical costs.
Most insurers have them.
Each one of them, you know, whether it's Aetna, United, Anthem, Cigna, they all have something.
Francois DeBrant is director of the Healthcare Incentives Improvement Institute. It's a nonprofit based in Connecticut, and its mission is to improve quality of care and the resources that consumers have to make healthcare decisions. DeBrant says these estimator tools are really hit or miss.
There's lots and lots of variability in the information that's provided to consumers.
Some reflect a range of possible costs. Some use historic pricing or claims information. He says many are limited in what procedures they include. And as Scott and Kate's experience shows, these tools may not be able to keep up with the fast-changing healthcare ecosystem. As for UnitedHealth's estimator, which Scott and Kate used.
Welcome to the UnitedHealthcare conferencing service.
I reached out to Craig Hankins. Yes. Hi, is this Craig?
Yeah. So this is Craig.
He oversees UnitedHealth's digital side. Hankins says the estimator launched in 2012. It's based on their actual payment agreements with doctors and hospitals, and it's updated regularly.
Well, right now, I would say if we look at our tool relative to others that are offered, I would say ours is average, if not above average, in terms of both the breadth of services as well as the accuracy.
Hankins says there is room for improvement, and it's in their own interest for it to work. If members get care at an acceptable cost, it saves everyone money. But even he says it's hard to predict what a doctor will actually do and how they will bill for it. For David Newman, director of the nonprofit Healthcare Cost Institute in Washington, D.C., that gets at a deeper challenge with these tools. The way billing and reimbursements work in healthcare is complicated.
There are 8,000 procedure codes.
Tens of thousands of diagnostic codes. Even a straightforward MRI has variables.
There's 1 million providers and suppliers in this country. And there's hundreds of insurance companies. And in real time, this is going to be probably as good as it gets.
But again, Francois Debrant with the Connecticut-based nonprofit doesn't necessarily agree.
It's not that difficult. It really, technologically and just technically, it's not that difficult.
The bigger problem, he says, is there's no pressure to make it work. Healthcare has thrived in an environment where costs are often hidden. He says, who would risk shaking that up?
Right now, there's still this reticence, this fear that it's too disruptive. There are going to be too many unintended consequences, meaning networks are going to blow up, people are going to be unhappy.
But Debrant says outside entities, especially, are starting to move the needle. Employers are demanding better estimates for employees. And several states now mandate reporting price information. All of this has Debrant and others feeling hopeful. As for Scott and Kate Savette, the current climate has turned them into a new breed of healthcare consumer, a savvy one. Kate says scheduling treatments will be a way of life for her now, but she's trying not to lose perspective. Cost was the last thing on her mind last winter, when all of a sudden she couldn't move her right hand, when her legs went numb.
I actually think it's just made me grateful for the health that I'm enjoying when I don't have a flare-up.
As for her husband, Scott Savette, he knows they're now nearing their $8,000 out-of-pocket cap, which means insurance will soon cover the entire cost of their care. But he doesn't want to give in. He wants to see improvements.
I would rather crawl to that $8,000 cap than sprint to it. I'd rather get there slowly. I know we're going to get there this year, unfortunately, but to blow it all in an MRI that's, you know, just excessively priced rubs me the wrong way.
Now, as a bonus chapter to this story, I connected with Scott a couple weeks after he had gotten an MRI. And get this, the bill was pretty close to what the estimator had predicted it would be, about $1,100. Scott says in that way, these tools can offer clues into costs. But his overall experience reminds him that these can be really murky, imperfect ones, and just part of what's needed to navigate through the mysteries of healthcare. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. A Mexican woman living in Texas was arrested at her gynecologist's office this month. The patient had overstayed her visa years before, and when she presented a fake driver's license at the reception desk, staffers alerted the police. This story and stories like it raise bigger questions about medical ethics, patient privacy, document fraud. Tanya English checks in on the immigrant health debate.
This house in North Philadelphia is busy after school. Two friends are visiting, an uncle is here, and sixth grader Alexa is at the kitchen table with her dad finishing up homework.
Copy this to here and correct the sentence, and I have to copy this and complete the analogy.
Her younger brothers are on the couch playing video games.
Marcos.
What's your name?
William.
Hi, William.
Alexa is all elbows and knees like many beautiful middle school girls, and she wears those black frame hipster glasses. You ask her who's in her family, and she has lots to say.
And my mom is 34, and my dad is 34.
Alexa was born in Mexico. Marcos and William were born in the United States.
What difference do you see between your brothers being born here and you being born somewhere different? Tell me the difference.
Alexa can't come up with anything quickly, but her mom, Estella, says when it comes to healthcare, her children are treated differently.
Pero pues ahí ya por todo me cobran. Si es por las vacunas, yo tengo que pagar como una consulta $25.
I have to pay for everything. Every time I go, it's $25. So if she needs a vaccine, I have to pay $25. On the other hand, if I take my sons, for instance, to Temple to get their vaccines, it's covered and I don't need to make an appointment.
This is a mixed status family. The boys are citizens. Estella, her husband, and Alexa entered the United States illegally. They want to talk about how hard it is to find health care. But to avoid unwanted attention, Estella asks that we only use first names. The boys are enrolled in Medicaid. Estella takes her daughter to a nearby health center that considers the family's income to figure out how much to charge.
Porque a veces no,
I take her when I have the money. Many times I have to decide whether to pay for her medical expenses or pay for rent. My landlord isn't going to wait for my rent. I have to be on time for that.
Estella's husband works the night shift cleaning supermarket floors and brings home about $1,600 a month. Estella says the rent, lights, gas, and water bills add up to $1,500 a month. In the kitchen, while she blends tomatoes and adds chili for lunch, Estella shares that at Alexa's last school physical, the doctor found signs of diabetes.
The thing that we're eating before has too much sugar and oil.
We've really restricted fats, sugars, soda. In my house, we don't drink any soda.
Estella's an activist with the New Sanctuary Movement. It's an immigrant justice group in Philadelphia. She's testified at the state capitol in Harrisburg and says her daughter and other kids like Alexa should be included in the federal Children's Health Insurance Program. But that's not the law now. Estella says fears about being reported and deported keep friends away from the hospital until they're really sick.
Many people are afraid because the first thing that happens when you go to the hospital is they'll ask for a green card or identification.
Unauthorized immigrants aren't allowed in the Medicaid program, and they don't qualify for private insurance subsidies through President Obama's health law. Ira Melman is a spokesman for the Federation of American Immigration Reform. He says U.S. immigration rules are already too relaxed.
The best way to deal with illegal immigration is to discourage people from coming to the country illegally in the first place.
Immigration reform groups are looking for ways to scale back health spending for undocumented workers and their families. One strategy is a debate over the 14th Amendment and something called birthright citizenship. Presidential frontrunner Donald Trump talked about the issue on Fox News with Bill O'Reilly.
We've spent last year $113 billion on illegal immigrants. We have to do something about it.
That's an estimate from the Federation of American Immigration Reform. It controversially includes the expenses for the American kids of immigrants. But Trump and others are also questioning that longstanding idea that a child born here to an undocumented worker is automatically an American.
Bill, I think you're wrong about the 14th Amendment. And frankly, the whole thing with anchor babies and the concept of anchor babies, I don't think you're right about that.
I
think
can
it's
quote
going
it.
To be
you want me to quote you the amendment? If you're born here, you're an American. Period. Period.
While the debate heats up, opponents say the U.S. citizen children of undocumented immigrants are one very good reason to provide better health care for their parents.
¿Podemos pasar? ¿Está aquí?
Meet baby Alan's mom.
Y este que tiene dos días de nacido. También varón.
He's her third son, born
duerme,
just 2 days ago.
Y duerme. Está bien, es tranquilo.
Alan's mom arrived in Philadelphia from Honduras in 2007. She asked that we not use her name.
En los dos últimos embarazos, tuve...
Baby Alan's mom was diagnosed with diabetes very early in her pregnancy. And she was sick enough that she needed checkups twice a week. She got that care through Latina Community Health Services at Pennsylvania Hospital.
Tratamiento médico. Ya no asistía a ninguna.
Before that, it had been 5 years since she had had medical care when she gave birth to her last baby.
This is La Mecca of prenatal care of Philadelphia around the world with six teaching hospitals. You will think that this is not an issue, but it's an issue.
The hospital's chair of obstetrics and gynecology, Jack Ludmere, says his clinic is a safety net for thousands of migrants from Mexico and more recently Guatemala and Honduras.
There are so many names, you know, illegal aliens, undocumented. A lot of people don't like to call them undocumented because some of them have documents, and a lot of people use the word unauthorized.
The fetus of a mom with diabetes faces big health risks, but Ludmere says baby Alan arrived healthy And Alan's mom is healthy too.
By providing prenatal care, I avoid complications. And when the baby is born, it's an American citizen that now qualifies for CHIP, for the Children Insurance Program. So the baby will be protected, and now we have to invest all these dollars on that child.
Ludmir says he has lots of critics.
Yeah, there are some lawmakers, and in particular the House of Representatives at the state level, that feel that clearly I'm committing a felony. That I'm committing a felony because, quote-unquote, I'm helping criminals.
In North Philadelphia, the Maria de los Santos Health Center and other federally funded clinics give care to people who cannot get it other places, regardless of their status. CEO Patty Deitch says that's her mission year in and year out, even in the middle of a contentious political season.
I have been able to maintain doing what we're doing without being in the middle of any political arguments about what people should or shouldn't have. I don't think I can answer that, whether undocumented people should have Medicaid, but they should have health care.
There are about 11 million foreign nationals in the United States without permission, and most don't have health insurance. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Baltimore's Inner Harbor is the gem of the city. It's a shopping hub and the first place tourists stop to check out the aquarium or tall ships docked there. But the harbor, much like the rest of the Chesapeake Bay, is still dirty. More than 1 million pounds of trash were removed from it just last year. After years of cleanup efforts in the harbor, a local nonprofit is now turning its attention to the trash in a totally different part of the city, far removed from the water. The Pulse's Carolyn Beeler reports.
Paula Ellerby has lived in the McElderry Park neighborhood of East Baltimore for more than 30 years. She remembers way back when the backyard and alley behind her row home were actually nice places to be.
Back in the day, we had trees, rose bushes, and my husband used to plant okra. He loved okra, right? Plant okra in the yard and tomatoes.
Neighborhood kids rode their bikes and played basketball in the alley.
It was like beautiful. You go out in your back and you know, you have your barbecue and the kids enjoy the alleys, and it was beautiful.
But about 10 years ago, Ellerby's alley became a dumping ground. She blames it on more renters moving onto the block. Others say many Baltimore neighborhoods have ups and downs, driven by the long-lasting effects of institutional racism, poverty, and the crack epidemic. Whatever the root cause, the alley behind Ellerby's house eventually filled up with garbage bags, loose trash, and mattresses. And with that trash came the rats.
And then the rats started making tunnels. Rat tunnels.
Ellerby paved over her backyard 6 or 7 years ago, but the alley behind it remained trash-strewn and rat-infested. That is, until this summer, when her alley got a makeover as part of a new project sponsored by the Healthy Harbor Initiative. Now, what does Ellerby's alley have to do with a healthy harbor? Well, accumulated trash has to go somewhere, and even in a city, it tends to flow downstream. In Baltimore, that means into the harbor. The initiative's community organizer, Leanna Wetmore, explains.
We collect trash at the Inner Harbor, but we also realize that in order to have clean water, we need to work upstream of these outfalls.
Outfalls are stormwater pipes that dump directly into the Inner Harbor. Trash that's thrown into alleys flows into storm drains when it rains and eventually passes through one of those outfalls into the water.
So you can do cleanups all day long, and it's not sustainable. So we designed this alley makeover project as sort of a fun, light way to work on trash.
Get rid of some of the trash in Baltimore's 600 miles of alleys, and there's less to flow into the harbor. The Healthy Harbor Initiative distributed free trash and recycling bins to neighbors living on 18 alleys and commissioned artists to beautify most of those as well. The residents were responsible for the elbow grease.
We pulled up weeds. We cleaned it up real good. They got the painting there.
Paula Ellerby is talking about a graffiti-style painting with big bubble letters a few houses down from hers that reads, "No dumping."
We worked. One yard had two matches in it, like rats were all up in there. They wanted to pull that thing out, them rats start coming out. Whew. But we got it.
The alley is now free of trash and weeds. So's the one behind Sadie Drescher's house. Her alley got a makeover just 2 weeks ago when neighborhood kids painted flowers on the ground.
We gave out over 120 trash bins and recycle bins to the neighbors, and we also did artist professional work as well as the kids got out and did art. And so people are kind of coming back out into the alley, and it's pretty and it's not so scary. So we can just do a quick walk down our alley.
One of the commissioned artists painted a stream of blue water filled with fish, clams, and a crab on the ground. It's made to look like the water is flowing into a storm drain in the middle of an alley. That was the only reminder I saw that the aim of the entire project is to prevent trash from flowing into Baltimore's waterways. Hallie Vandergag, director of the environmental group Blue Water Baltimore, says that was a strategic decision.
We find in Baltimore that people may not care about the bay or the Inner Harbor, but they really care about trash and rats and what's happening in their back alley in their neighborhood. And so we used to go in talking about stormwater and sewage and healthy waterways, and now we really talk about healthy communities.
Indianapolis, Los Angeles, and Louisville have also targeted alleys for cleanup, but none were spurred by the desire to keep trash out of the water, like in Baltimore. Community organizer Leanna Wetmore plans to expand the alley makeover program with the city of Baltimore soon. She hopes a recent mayoral pledge to provide every city household with a free trash can will help too. As for Paula Ellerby, she has visions someday of ripping up the concrete and replanting a garden in her backyard.
Yes, I would love that. And I'm not a country girl. My mom always sent me down to country when I was young, but give me some okra and some tomatoes and I'm good.
For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're going to move from Maryland to Colorado with another story on cleaning up water. The Environmental Protection Agency accidentally caused a spill of 3 million gallons of polluted mine waste into Colorado's Animas River in August of this year during what was supposed to be a cleanup effort, an epic fail with big consequences. But even before the spill, mines in Colorado and across the West were leaking toxic materials into thousands of mountain streams. From Colorado, reporter Stephanie Page Ogburn has more.
Kerber Creek runs through a wide valley below the spine of the Continental Divide, about a four-hour drive southeast of Denver. Carol Wagner and her husband moved here in 1986.
It's always been a cattle ranch with calves are born here.
There's views of 13,000-foot mountains, and the creek winds through the middle of the property. But when the Wagners first moved here, Kerber Creek had a problem.
Nothing could live in it. We didn't understand why in the beginning. And then it turned out that there had been a mine spill, and it had just destroyed everything.
Before that spill, the creek would have been jumping with trout and full of aquatic bugs. To understand what killed Kerber Creek, we need to drive 15 miles up a bumpy dirt road to the Bonanza Mining District.
Start seeing the structure up there on the right.
Oh, whoa. That's big.
Several stories high.
Jason Willis works for Trout Unlimited on mine cleanups across Colorado. We climb up and around the Coco Mongo Mill and Mine.
A little steep.
It's all kinds of colors. Orange and red and kind of a gray, white, brown, and there's just piles and piles of this waste all over the place. You can see it here. And then the creek just runs right through the middle of the valley.
Kind of sticks out like a sore thumb in between aspen trees and pine trees and grass up on the hill slope. If you could imagine basically a football field filled with mill tailings.
You heard right. That pile of waste could fill an entire football field several stories high. And this spot is far from unique. The government estimates there are about 30,000 abandoned mines contaminating waterways across the West. Mines that extracted everything from gold and silver to uranium and lead. Cleaning them up is a huge job. So to get a better sense for how a cleanup works, we headed over to one that was recently finished.
This is what it looked like down below on Squirrel Creek.
Ugh, that looks nasty.
Indeed.
Laura Archuleta is showing me a picture of a mine cleanup in action at the Raleigh 12 mine tunnel. Archuleta works on cleanups for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The very first time I was ever here in the late 1990s, that was a very huge holding pond for the water that was draining out of there, and then they would treat that before it would get released.
The water they were treating is acid mine drainage. As water runs over mine waste and tailings, it turns acidic and picks up heavy metals.
Lead, zinc, copper, cadmium, other things on that line, a lot of iron. And so when the chemistry happens, they can release those metals into the water and it flows downstream.
Downstream to Carol Wagner's ranch, 15 miles below. To plug the leak, cleanup workers had to partially rebuild the mine tunnel. Then it took hundreds of dump truck loads to remove the tons of mine waste at this site. But now, after years of work, there are signs of life.
Dandelions are actually a good indicator. I just saw a dandelion plant. Dandelions will not grow in metals-enriched soils.
The Raleigh 12 mine cleanup worked, and that's a good thing. Downstream is everything from potato fields to the Rio Grande River, flowing through cities like Albuquerque and El Paso, all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. But the mine cleanup cost millions of dollars, and finding funds is a big barrier to large-scale cleanups, says University of Colorado law professor Mark Squillaci. Right now, mines on public land pay no royalties to the government.
You could easily impose a fee on the tonnage that's produced from these mines in a way that would fund a program to reclaim hard rock mines.
Liability is another issue. Groups like Trout Unlimited often won't take on big cleanups because they fear being sued under the Clean Water Act. It would take a law change to ease that liability threat. Legislation to address these problems has been proposed, but has failed to pass so far. After the Raleigh 12 mine got cleaned up, Jason Willis and Trout Unlimited were finally able to begin work down at Kerbert Creek at Carol Wagner's ranch. Beside the creek, an excavator is lifting giant boulders.
So what Mike's doing is he is installing a rock barb, which is a rock structure to help maintain the bank stability and the channel stability going around this bend.
The heavy equipment also tills in lime to neutralize the soil and compost to help plants grow. It's been 3 years so far, and Carol Wagner sees a huge difference.
Now there's trout living here in the creek, and a lot of wildlife are here. It's just changed everything.
You might be able to call the cleanup here a success story, but it's one that was 2 decades in the making. The work on the Wagner's ranch will cost millions of dollars and will take a few more years to complete. Multiply that by the tens of thousands of creeks like Kerber that need this kind of work, and you get the idea. Across the West, we'll be cleaning up our mining mess for years to come. For The Pulse, I'm Stephanie Page Ogburn.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, our associate producer, Joel Patterson is our managing editor, and Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? Just subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And here's a little quiz for you. Can you guess why we're playing this very song to end our show? It's related to a big health story that was in the news and especially rocked Twitter this week. If you know the answer, tweet at us. We're at WHYY The Pulse. Your reward, geek glory, of course. And if you can't figure it out, but you just have to know the answer, I'll tell you. You just have to sign up for our newsletter. You can do that at whyy.org/pulse-newsletter. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Supporting WHYY is The Pulse. AstraZeneca strives to create a culture where employees are excited by their work, have a clear sense of purpose, and display confidence in their ability to meet challenges and seize opportunities. More at AstraZeneca.com/careers.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.